Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 hello. As always, really glad to have this opportunity to talk to some of the brightest, most honest, ethical, and reform-minded people on the earth today. It's an honor to speak to you. It's an honor to present my guests to you. And today I'm particularly honored, as I have been on a number of other occasions, to be having my dear friend Pam Popper on the show. There are always just tons and tons of reasons to talk to Pam Popper. But one of the reasons for today is just to remind you that I'm going to be next week in her home area, Columbus, Ohio, co-sponsoring a conference with Pam. It's on Friday and Saturday and Sunday, November 10, 11, and 12. I'll be getting in the day before for some activities, and I'm going to hang around and do some more things. And Peter Goetz is going to be there, and a whole group of Peter Goetz, by the way, most of you listening to my show know, is the amazing Danish physician who in recent years has begun to write books about psychiatry like none other, that are so revealing, so honest, so interestingly written. And he'll be there. He'll be doing two presentations. My friend Jeannie Stolzer will also be there talking about childhood and raising kids, and particularly about the importance of relationship, parental relationships, and the mother-child bond. It'll be a great conference. You can learn about it by going to my website, Breggin.com, and looking at my upcoming events, which right now is very limited to this upcoming conference. I've got no other travel on the horizon, folks, except for going to trials to testify, and you won't be seeing me there. So this is a great opportunity, and Pam can tell us some more about the conference. There's so much to say about Pam, and I'm trying to think about what's most important. I can tell you what's most important to me. Pam has saved my wife, Ginger, and hence me, from decades of Ginger suffering as a result of the food she was eating. Ginger's had multiple immunological disorders, all of which she's recovered from one after another, which I don't get into much and I won't today, but she ended up with decades now of ulcerative colitis with horrible shifting joint pains, which many doctors don't know commonly go along with this disorder. And I came home from the last conference where it really wasn't a conference, where I was being filmed by Pam for our current course, which she is teaching and using along with a young psychiatrist doing a great job and using a lot of videos of me on why and why to come off psych drugs. And I came back from that event having met a lot of people helped by Pam, and I decided to go on her diet because I just couldn't lose weight. Well, in just weeks, I lost 28 pounds, and I've been holding there. I'm now at 30 pounds under where I was, been holding there for a while because I think my body said, slow down. We got to adapt to this fella. I look a lot different. I've thrown away my blood pressure medicine. It's really amazing. And Ginger was cooking for me because she loves me, and even though she didn't want to eat the food in the beginning, which is – for her would have been very plain food to begin with, like potatoes and rice and a few other things, because she's got ulcerative colitis with daily pain and daily shifting joint pain. I didn't have to begin with a bland diet. And within a month, Ginger no longer had any symptoms of colitis. So we're now several months into my wife no longer being unable to travel, no longer being bound near the house, no longer in chronic pain, no longer fighting with her brilliance, her high intelligence and passionate feelings, no longer struggling to get through the pain, the discomfort, and the enslavement that ulcerative colitis gives people. She's well, and I owe it to the woman that I'm introducing you to, Pam Popper. People sometimes say to me, you know, you saved my life, or you saved my child's life, or you saved my husband's life. And I never quite let it sink in, and my usual sense of it is to say, well, you know, that's what I'm here to do. That's why you came to me, and I'm honored to have helped you. And today I told Pam Popper, even more firmly than ever, and my wife in the background yelled, yes, thank you, that you have really saved the quality of life and perhaps life itself of Ginger Breggin, and you've helped me a lot. And God bless you, Pam Popper. So this, folks, is nutritionist Pam Popper, my dear friend, collaborator, coworker. Hi, Pam.
Hi, and gosh, that was an amazing introduction. Thank you so much. And, you know, it's my pleasure. I mean, I love what I do. I love seeing people change their health and get control of their health and get well. I mean, isn't that what we're supposed to do when we show up every day in this field that we're in? And unfortunately, isn't it amazing that it doesn't happen with a great degree of regularity, that people are astounded when it does happen? Like, oh my gosh, you got well? Like, wow, somebody actually did that. I mean, that's what's wrong with medicine. People are not getting well. We've totally lost sight as a profession of what we're supposed to be doing. So my pleasure to help you and Ginger. I love you both dearly. And so one of the reasons why I want to do this kind of work is we have to keep good people on the planet for as long as possible, because they have a lot of wonderful work to do, right?
I want to remind folks, they may have seen Pam in the film Forks Over Knives. And Pam draws on the tradition, not tradition, but the scientific background of Colin Campbell. And people know about his famous China study. And Pam's books include Food Over Medicine and Solving America's Healthcare Crisis. Which of your books, Pam, has sold hundreds of thousands of copies now?
The Forks Over Knives companion book, which I'm a co-author of, has sold a few hundred thousand copies. And then Food Over Medicine is still doing well. It just got converted to an audiobook. And, of course, the book is written in conversational form, so it lends itself really well to an audiobook. And they found somebody to be me who sounds just like me. I couldn't believe it when they sent me the audition tapes. I said, oh, my gosh, she's very familiar with medical terminology. So it's really a fun audiobook, too. So we've had quite a bump in people who I think were waiting for the audiobook. People don't like to read so much anymore. They like listening.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Pam and I, we were talking about what to discuss today in particular. And Pam brought up something that's been more and more in my mind, because I've been encouraging pretty much all my patients or clients to try this new diet. And people who are coming off meds, and so many of my clients, especially the women, have serious gastrointestinal problems, and even the children, the young girl children. So I'm encouraging them to do the diets. I'm beginning to have some success with it. And and we started talking about, obesity. I think you must have brought it up, Pam. Oh, it's about, because I'm going to be talking about a filmmaker about obesity when I get to Pam's conference. And so we decided we kind of have a good look at that today. And, you know, if this isn't a topic of special interest, don't stop listening, folks. You're going to learn. You're going to learn. And it should be a topic for everybody, because we all have loved ones who are overweight if we're not overweight. Or often we have little children that are overweight. And so we're going to focus on that for a while and on proper eating along the way. And Pam, the mic is yours now for as long as you want on that subject or any other one.
Well, I won't talk for a long time, but one of the things that I say to people who have a weight problem is that the type of thing that leads to a weight problem is the same type of thinking and life's issues that lead to all kinds of other problems. And, you know, I've had my share of challenges. I've worked on myself a lot over the years because I've found all kinds of things that need to be fixed in order for me to be a happy person and to live at peace with people around me and that sort of thing. So my point is that many times I'll be sitting in the office with an obese person, and I tell them, you know, just so you know, we're both exactly alike. There's just one little difference. The problem that you're having, we see it on your body. All of my problems are up in my head, very messy up there. They just don't show on my body. I'm a skinny person, but lots of mess up there because I struggle with issues too. Yours involves eating. Mine involves a quick temper and some other things that I've had to work on dealing with over the years in order to be successful in life. And so when you said don't stop listening if you don't have a problem with this, we all have a problem with something. I have not met the first perfect person yet. And if they're out there, please call us on this show. We'd like to interview you because you're the only one. So none of us is perfect. We all have issues, and they're shockingly alike. They're just different behaviors, but they're all driven by some of the same things, like insecurity, unhappiness, you know, just bad habits picked up at an early age and these kinds of things. And the obese person, like I said, just happens to look the part more than somebody like me. So having said that, I think that there are a lot of misunderstandings about how to address the obesity issue. And I'll tell you how bad the misunderstandings are. The failure rate, and I still find this statistic astounding every time I tell it, for an obese person who is, you know, obese, maybe weighing 400 or 500 pounds, the failure rate for a person who's obese to lose 25 pounds and keep it off for 1 year is over 99%.
Oh, God.
Now, it's horrible. And so here's what I think about this. There's a tendency to write all this off that, well, people are lazy and they don't care and they don't want to discipline themselves and they don't want to exercise. Well, if you look at the size of the marketplace for weight loss plans and all that sort of thing, I don't think that indicates a lack of interest. And I think that at some point in time, the medical profession, the healing arts, we have to look inside ourselves and say, listen, if this isn't working, maybe we should take a look at what we're doing, what we're advising. If it doesn't work, you have to find another strategy. And I started looking into this a few years ago when I saw that even the failure rate here with obesity was still remaining pretty high. And I found out that, I think, why a lot of this stuff doesn't work. And I'm not saying there aren't any lazy people who don't care out there. There are. But the vast majority of people who weigh 400 or 500 pounds, they really wish that they didn't. And they are willing to try things. But we just continually do things to them that have no hope of working. And so maybe that's a good place to start our discussion. What's wrong with weight loss programs, and what can we do differently that might be more helpful?
Great. Please continue with that. What's wrong with the weight loss programs, and what can we do?
Well, there's one thing I think to start looking at this issue is that trying to break a bad eating habit is a little bit different than breaking a drug habit. You know, I can go for the rest of my life and never be in the same room with heroin. It's pretty easy to avoid heroin, really. But you can't go till the end of today without being around food, and we have to eat it. And so I think one of the problems is that a lot of times food is approached as an addiction. People say, well, you're just addicted to food, and so the reason why you eat is because all people who are addicted, they're pleasure-seeking people. So if you take drugs, you want to get high. If you drink too much, it's because you want to feel high. If you eat too much, it's because you love binge eating. And so the first thing is we have a stark difference between food and drugs and alcohol, because you can not drink and not take drugs, but you have to eat. But the second thing is, and I'll never forget this, somebody sitting in the office, I learn a lot from the people I'm trying to help, by the way, and this was a very, very big turning point for me. This guy was a drinker, an alcoholic, And I don't know what I said that triggered this, but he said something to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing, "You think this is pleasure seeking?" He says, "You know, I go to bars. I spend money I don't have. I sleep in my car. I've wet my pants. I have had a DUI. I spent my vacation last year in jail." He says, "What about any of that sounds like fun to you?" And boy, that was a wake-up call. Because I think there is a tendency to think that these kinds of behaviors are pleasure-seeking, and they're not. They're pain-resolving. In other words, nobody puts themselves through that on a daily basis thinking that they're having a great time. They're just trying to not feel so awful. And so I stopped looking at this behavior, this eating behavior, as pleasure-seeking and looked at it as pain avoidance instead. I started looking at this addiction model of obesity as really being quite foolish because it doesn't get you anywhere. The failure rate for Alcoholics Anonymous is over 93%. The failure rate for rehab is like 97%. So if there's well, that in itself is a reason to separate obesity from the rest of it, because the rest of it is so miserably unhelpful to people that why would we want to have a program for eating that mirrors all of that, right? So I started looking at this from a different perspective, and I realized that the first thing we had to do is we had to start talking to people about what is the pain that you're trying to get rid of? What triggers you to do this? I mean, something, there's a story you're telling yourself or a thought that's occurring to you when you're getting ready to go to Krispy Kreme and get a dozen donuts. What is it? And people are surprisingly, if you ask them good questions, they're surprisingly intuitive and they know a lot about themselves. And I've never asked that question where somebody couldn't tell me exactly what was going on. I get scared. I get anxious. I have difficult confrontations with people. I get overwhelmed. I mean, they can tell you exactly what it is. And then you ask them, do you know that this is coming? A lot of times, yes, you know. And so I think that's the first thing, is realizing that lecturing, trying to scare people, you know, a lot of things that we used to do, we'd give them a lecture about how bad it is to be obese. Do you realize your risk factors for everything are higher and that sort of thing? And they know all that, by the way, and they're kind of offended that you treat them like they're 5 years old reviewing all that again, like they didn't hear it the first 46 times somebody told them. So really zeroing in on the real issue, which is that you don't need for me to explain the eating plan to you again. You went to the class. You understand it. So why don't we zero in on what's driving the behavior that's causing you so much grief? And often I refer people to a good therapist because that's not my special thing, although I think I'm pretty good at talking to people. But once they start getting in touch with why they do what they do, they begin to think about it differently. And I'll tell you something else that works really, really well that I discovered, and that is that I start telling people, what I want you to do is I want you to start experiencing being really fully present for this, what it feels like to eat in this way. Okay, so instead of the mindless eating, like you go through the drive-thru, you get the donuts and you're eating them when you're driving home and kind of thinking about other things and all that sort of thing, I want you to sit there and I want you to really taste the donuts in your mouth and think about, say to yourself, I'm binge eating now. I mean, I really had a stressful day and I am binge eating. And I'm having my fourth donut, fully mentally present, experience this. You know what people would say when they come back in here? They go, I can't believe how disgusted I was by the whole thing. I mean, I didn't even finish the donuts or those French fries or whatever the heck it is they were going to go binge on. And this is the beginning of that mental presence for the habit that you've formed starting to make you a little dissatisfied with it. Like, it's really not working. I mean, I went to Krispy Kreme or McDonald's or wherever I was going or to get six pizzas. I went to get this food because I thought it was going to make me feel better, but when I really started thinking about it when I was eating it, it's certainly making me feel a lot worse. This just isn't as fun as I used to remember it. And that can be the beginning of turning things around a little bit and having a different attitude. It's a hard ship to turn around because sometimes by the time people come in here and they're really overweight or obese, they've been doing this for a few decades. And by the way, just translating that, you know, if you eat badly for 10 or 20 years, you're talking about, you know, if you eat five times a day, you know, you're talking about thousands of times you've practiced. So that's a lot of practice doing the wrong thing. It's definitely difficult to turn around. But those are some of my thoughts about this. And I think if you take it from there and start to make people aware of what's driving this, fully experiencing it and all of its god-awful full-blown experience, and then beginning to learn to make different choices and going to somebody for help to address the things that you've been not dealing with that you've thought that three pizzas would solve. And sometimes people come out the other side a lot better. I mean, our chef here is a good example. He's lost 225 pounds and kept it off for now 7 years. And he's not skinny yet, but I'll tell you what, when you think about the 99% failure rate for keeping 25 pounds off, we should be building a statue in his honor in the parking lot and having people come to pay respects, right? So anyway, yeah. That's my story.
When I think about what helped me, and I think helped Ginger be able to stay on the food plan that you have, you know, she and I are pretty self-aware people, and I make a living trying to be self-aware, and I certainly know a lot of the reasons why I've basically been overweight my entire life. I mean, when I ran track and set records in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade in 100-yard dash, I was the chubby kid in the lead. So this goes back. In fact, I was so shy in the 6th grade about being overweight that when it came for the track meet that was going to sort of establish who were the good athletes going into the combined school, it was a big deal. This was, you know, all the sixth grades from the three major school districts came together who were going on into the intermediate or middle school. And many of us didn't know each other. We'd heard about each other. And I was so shy about my weight that I didn't wear shorts for the track meet. I wore jeans. And there's a picture of me somewhere. I don't know if I could ever find it again. You know, handily winning, running in my jeans.
So, which sounds
so uncomfortable.
This goes
back a long way for me. And I didn't have track shoes either. I don't know what I was running in. But what really helped, and there have been other times in my life when I was, very thin, but not for long periods of time. What helped me was learning from you what foods were really good for me and what foods were practically toxic or were, like dairy, indeed toxic. That was a huge help. And the idea that I could eat as much of those as I wanted of the good foods, and we should talk about them along the way, but the basis of the diet is whole grains, potatoes, squash, corn, legumes, then vegetables, steamed, raw, big salads, green tea, which I love, sprouts and so on. That's like the basis, and it's about what people ate. It's about the whole food itself and not the processed food. It's about avoiding meats or using them sparingly, which I do. Once I knew exactly what the story was, that I had to fall back on, if I also wanted to get rid of some of the gastric pain I had to do this, and that this would help me in general. And that was a big help to me. And then when I followed it, I called you at one point and I was having a little trouble and you reminded me that I can't eat oils, it's fat. I shouldn't be eating all those vegetables that are so fat that I love to eat. I should be avoiding the high fat foods and being careful to read things. And you correct me and kind of guide the audience on what I'm saying to you. But when I got it straight, what I was supposed to do, and within a week, my stomach felt better. And within 2 weeks, I thought I was feeling faint from weight loss, but it turned out that wasn't it at all. It was that my blood pressure medicine now was causing me to become hypotensive because my natural blood pressure now was normal for a young man, not an old man. So I saw the results right away, and I knew what I had to do. And when I deviated, it didn't work very well. And Ginger has had that same experience. Soon as she started this eating properly, and no deviation, no ice cream, none of this, no milk, no cheese. You know, as soon as she got straight what it was and she started to do it, she saw the immediate results and then the results of deviation. So that, I think, I don't know whether this meets with a lot of other folks, but that was just critical to me, was knowing exactly what to eat, why to eat it, why I shouldn't deviate, and seeing such fast results doing it.
Well, you're right. And for a certain segment of the population, that absolutely works. And when people come in here, I've always said the people who have the worst health are the easiest to work with because they literally are willing to do anything. I've had people say, sitting in my office, see the grass outside there? If you tell me to go graze on the grass, I'm going to go do it because I can't live like this anymore. I think the thing that is different about the obese person is that from an intellectual standpoint, because they're not stupid people, from an intellectual standpoint, they understand exactly what you just said. The problem is that there's a big gap between their ability to intellectually understand it and the habits that that person may have formed and the
sure.
way that that person looks at food. And so, you know, I also had the same experience. I mean, I used to be fat. And so, fortunately, nothing else was wrong with me at the time. I'm sure something would have been by now, but I changed to the right diet. I dropped a bunch of weight. You know, I never had to worry about it anymore. And so the very frustrating thing for the person who has a perpetual weight problem, particularly the obese person, is they watch all this going on, and they say, there's something wrong with me. And then the fact that this is looked upon as pleasure-seeking and a character defect by others who can be very judgmental about this. And what happens is, and I think there's an attempt to be helpful. Like other people think, I need to let you know, how destructive you are and look what you're doing to yourself. And, you know, even if they don't say it, that attitude can be pretty front and center. Sometimes what you don't say is louder than what you do. And so the person now feels worse about themselves than they ever did before, and it drives more of the bad behavior. So I think that we have to separate people into we can separate people into a lot of categories, but for purposes of our discussion, I think we have people who want to get well. They don't eat for wrong reasons. It's not psychologically motivated. They don't do this for the wrong reason. You tell them what to do, they do it, they get well, the weight comes off, the drugs go away, they go, gosh, I wish I'd known about this 20 years ago, and they live happily ever after. And then you have people who really struggle with this. And then there's a third category that I'll bring up too. And the third category is the person who maybe isn't even obese, but just suffers from some health issues and some weight problems, and just does not know how to organize life around taking care of oneself. There's a line in one of your books, I think it's Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, where you talk about people being taught from an early age to not be selfish, but that doesn't mean you should be selfless. In other words, if I'm going to be good to my family and good to my kids and good to my community and good to my employer, that doesn't necessarily mean that I therefore have to ignore myself. And that's the sucker's choice that people fall into. I can't do all the things that I'm supposed to do for all of the other responsibilities I have and take care of myself, so I'll just lop that off. I won't worry about it. They can change real fast if they have a life-threatening disease, but short of that, sometimes people will always put themselves second. So I think there's a certain mentality that gets in the way of some people getting well. But back to our obese friends who really struggle with eating. They have an eating disorder. I think that that their issues are, I understand exactly what you're telling me. I'm smart. I get it. I see what's happened to you, and I know that that could happen for me. But I'm still driven to do this destructive thing because it's been a habit. I mean, sometimes people will come in here and tell me, a 55-year-old person say, I started doing this when I was 8. Well, my gosh, you've sure had a lot of practice. You know, you've eaten, what, 60,000 meals? 60,000 repetitions of anything is a lot, and it's hard to undo.
Do you find that a lot of by the way, I do have food issues. So
I
nonetheless, despite a lot of looking at the food issues and thinking about them and doing, changing certain things about how I approach evening, because a lot of my eating was in the evening, and if you'd been in my family, you would have wanted to do anything in the evening other than what was going on. But I did find knowing knowing a good diet, a really scientifically based diet consistent with human evolution that immediately had a good effect, I think was in some ways, and I'm saying this as a psychiatrist, psychologist, psychotherapist, in some ways was more important than the insight. And I'm noticing it with some of my clients, too, you know, because I'm my patients, I'm talking to them about this. And people, I haven't done it long enough yet to know what the ultimate results are going to be. But some people are seeing results in their skin in the first week, in their waistline in the first week, their children. I see families, the kids notice it, or if it's their mother or father. So I want to emphasize not just the psychological understanding, which probably is the most familiar thing to this audience, but also the importance of having the right way to eat, because I think a lot of those diets are failing because they're literally almost the opposite of what your notion is about nutrition.
Yeah, it's again, we're back to the same thing that it so makes sense. And what's happened is, you and I talked about this before we started the show, about how humans didn't used to have to make choices. You know, when we were hunter-gatherers and, you know, food, there was no grocery store, you had to go out and find what you're going to eat. You really had a limited number of wrong choices that you could make. And the wrong choice would tend to be something like you ate something poisonous or you ate something that was rotten. I mean, you're going to die because you ate something bad, not because you went to the store and bought candy instead of eating the grapes. You know, that wasn't available to early man. And so, you know, now we're in a situation where eating involves making choices. And you can make a decision to eat bad things and go for a long time before it catches up with you. I was just doing a workshop on forming and maintaining optimal habits, and one of the things I said is what makes it difficult to change diet and lifestyle habits particularly is that nobody frowns immediately on what you're doing. So if I sit at my desk and I eat Fritos, all right, here would be a big thing. People would take pictures and put it on Facebook. But if I was just working at the local AAA office and I sat at my desk and ate a package of Fritos today, nobody would think anything of it. You don't get fired from your job. Nothing happens. If I didn't go to the gym for 6 weeks, nothing terrible happens right away. So we can make really bad choices. We have lots of bad choices available. And then we can get away with it for an extraordinarily long period of time. And furthermore, we're completely confused by the inaccurate messages that we're given every day about diet and health and the right diet for humans and all that sort of thing. And so most people have the wrong ideas about food. And it's difficult to put all that aside. I'm sure that there was a part of you that was saying, how could this all have been so messed up for so long? How could I not have known this? I mean, I felt that way when I found out. I thought I was a smart person, thought I was pretty with it. So how is it that I got to this age and had all the wrong ideas about food? And then right after that, I found out I had all the wrong ideas about anything pertaining to health, all of it, all a mess. But anyhow, I think that's what makes this all difficult too is this new food thing involves leaving behind a lot of ideas that are really ingrained. I mean, people have been told that milk builds strong bones since they were five, right? So think about how strange it sounds for somebody to say, the more of that stuff you drink, the more fractures you're going to get. Really? How can that be? Because if that's true, that means my pediatrician lied to my parents. That means what I learned in school, my teachers were lying to me, the government is lying to me. Well, we might all know that that's true, but it's different to admit and really come to grips with the fact that you bought the story. Nobody likes feeling as they've been had, right? So at some point in time, any of us who come around to this new way of thinking about diet and all the other things that we do here, part of what makes it difficult is being able to say to yourself, which is not an easy thing to say, I've been had in a big way, you know, by a lot of people. And how could I have bought that all hook, line, and sinker? So, you know, that's what makes spreading the word about this really challenging, I think.
Yes, it is. And it's such a wider pattern, too, of what I'm calling now the industrialization of our lives, especially our children's lives, where it's what they eat is what industry dictates and promotes and pushes, what we imbibe in the way of alcohol, what we put in our mouths as pills, what we accept as education, what we believe is politics. It's on and on how much the giant, and you and I are both capitalistically oriented, but how much these giant corporations and the government are literally just treating us like industrial consumers, and we're pushed and pulled in this and that direction. Because your diet, your view of food, I know you're very proud of the fact that the person could eat it on food stamps. And Ginger and I have noticed a huge drop in the cost of living for us. First, because we don't go to restaurants much anymore. But second, because the food we're buying is, in fact, not very expensive food. Dairy is very expensive. Meats, right. Bad meats are very expensive, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the person who gets hurt the most out of all of this, and this is what bothers me. We have a lot of discussion about equality in this country, and I think in some cases that discussion is appropriate to have, but we're always worried about the disadvantaged person and what are we going to do to help that person. Well, the disadvantaged person in our country falls victim to all these wrong stories and wrong information more than anybody else and has almost no option. I mean, I'm sure you see this in the psychiatry business. The person who's on public assistance better darn well show up for the appointments and take the drugs, because you can have your benefits taken away if you don't do it. You know, so and let alone the fact that you would think that, and I was talking about this in class last night with the Why and How to Withdraw group, you would think that that we would say people who are economically disadvantaged, have social disadvantages and all this sort of thing, we would take our best resources and apply them to those people because they need the most help. That's not what happens. They get the worst possible help and assistance. And meanwhile, other people who have money to pay can choose if they want to go to a psychiatrist or get off their drugs or change their diet or pay out of pocket to come and see me instead of I have to go where my insurance will pay because I'm not covered by insurance. And so this really falls upon, you know, what do we have, 47 million people on food stamps in this country? And they're falling further and further behind with this issue of how to eat, how to take care of yourself, how to get yourself healthy, how to stay out of the medical mill. They're falling further and further behind. And that's an issue of inequality that I wonder why everybody doesn't want to talk more about.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely true. And when they get sick, they get the worst. They just get slapped on multiple drugs, psychiatric or medical. And they're treated like, as one professor of mine said years and years ago, and I think he was thinking this, well, the clinic, we just got all these people coming to it who have poor protoplasm. Now, I can't even remember exactly what protoplasm is. I think it's that fluid in the cells where all the stuff takes place or something. But, I mean, what a way of degrading people rather than saying we're not teaching them to eat right, they don't get the right foods, we're not helping them. You know, chronicity serves everybody except the victim. It mm-hmm. serves the doctors, it serves the drug companies, it probably even serves TV and the media. Because healthy people will do a lot of other things, and I think that we definitely breed, we're pushing people toward chronicity. I mentioned that in an earlier show that I recently had conversations with two people who worked actively with drug companies in the near future, not distant past. Fairly recently worked for drug companies, who told me that it was cocktail conversation, let alone in-house policy, that the drugs you wanted to manufacture and sell were the ones that didn't cure, but simply kept people in a chronic state. I mean, like as cynical as I am, I mean, it was just something to hear these people talk about how awful that was and that it actually was a mindset. So you're coming along and you're saying if you eat right, among other things, exercise and maybe a few other things, you're not going to have chronic illnesses, or they're not going to be disabling, runs counter to the entire money-making machine.
Right. And by the way, I was asked about this one time, is there a vast conspiracy out there? Like, I think the visualization people have is that a bunch of executives from, big agriculture, big food, big drug, and government agencies sit around a table in a boardroom in New York and say, we have got to hatch a plan to keep America sick. That's not the way it's happening. It's a much more insidious thing. That would actually be easier to take care of, because you just go to the people. You could file a complaint with the Justice Department against the people who sat at that table and made these decisions, and you could really do some harm that way to those people. The way that this all happens, it's through a very insidious process that sometimes starts with a good idea that gets co-opted. I teach a course called Nutritional Issues and Controversies, and people love this course. It's one of those love-hate relationships. I'm loving learning this, but it's making my head hurt. Because if you look at government policy, where it pertains to nutrition, for example, one of the things that we talk about is a lot of the processed foods are too calorie dense, and then this fortified junk food that gets marketed as health food and all that sort of thing. Well, there was a period of time where the government was partnering with food companies to make fortified foods and to increase the calorie density of food. And it was a good idea, and one of the reasons it was a good idea was because people were starving. I mean, remember reading Grapes of Wrath? That was a fictional story, but it represented a very real thing that was happening in America, which is there were a lot of people who didn't have enough food. So the context and the time in which some of these things start, it can make a whole lot of sense, and then it just grows into a beast that for reasons. The reason for doing it's long past, but now it takes on a life of its own. And I'm sure, as you've seen in your work and I've seen in mine, you get to a certain point where, quote-unquote, everybody knows that something is a good idea to do, and you just can't dial it back. It's no longer a good idea. It no longer serves the purpose. In fact, it's hurting instead of helping, and you just can't make it stop. So, and then I'll tell you what I think complicates it more than anything at this point, and this is where we do have to place responsibility on individuals, is people, they like to think that they don't have to think about this stuff. I don't want to think about politics. I don't want to think about my elected officials. I don't want to think about laws that are pending in my state. I don't want to check things out before I do them. And so there's a little bit of abdication going on, not about trying to improve health, because most people are trying to do that, but about getting the right information so that you can get things done in a productive way. So people call me all the time telling me about all kinds of terrible misbehavior going on in the medical field, or laws, licensure laws that are keeping them from practicing and all this sort of thing. I tell them, well, who's your state representative? Well, I don't know. Who's your state senator? I don't know. I've gotten to the place I tell them, get yourself registered to vote and send me evidence of that, and then I'll talk to you, because if you don't care enough to participate, How am I going to solve all the world's problems for you, So I think that's another thing, too, is the dumbing down of America, where people just are so disengaged from thinking that what's going on around them is important. It's real hard to change things, anything, under those circumstances. So we need somebody who's a lot smarter than I am to figure out how to get the population back engaged in being the population again, because people used to care a lot more about this stuff.
Yes, absolutely. Well, yeah, in our own way, you and I are both doing as much as we can to educate the public and to let folks know how important it is to, as you would say, make informed medical decision making.
Well, I had a thought in yoga this morning I'll share with you. There's an organization called People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA.
Sure.
I think we should start a group called People for the Ethical Treatment of People. for making sure the animals are taken care of.
Here we are on the radio. Maybe we could begin that idea.
Seriously, because that's what a lot of this is involves. I mean, we have to start somehow telling the truth to people and making people demand the truth. Because it is so easy to lie. Our politicians lie every day. I watch them do it. I watch them answer questions. You ever watch some of these Sunday morning shows? They ask a politician a question, and then he talks about something entirely different. And I want to scream into the television set, interrupt that guy, and tell him he's not answering your question. Make him answer the question you ask, but they don't do that. And so that's just an example of just letting people slip and slide. We let medical doctors slip and slide and not tell the truth. I was sharing with you earlier that I was on the phone with a person who's over-medicated. And we looked at data from some trials where the specific doses of the drugs he's taking and the specific number of drugs were involved. And it was just dreadful outcomes. And, of course, his doctor never told him that. His doctor, in fact, told him, the thing we're doing now is we're giving more drugs because we find it's better. Okay, it's 1.6% better. And, by the way, we kill 23 for every 16 we help. Really? You know, so people are buying what others are selling, and doctors are selling treatment. We must remember that, and they're not holding people accountable to tell them the truth. You know, I would think you'd ask a lot of questions when somebody wants to give you five drugs at a time, but people don't because they've been taught to trust. It's one more thing I don't have to think about. I can believe in my doctor. Yeah.
And they also become less sharp and actually less intelligent as the drugs begin to make them apathetic and unaware of themselves and their feelings and what's happening to them.
I've been so aware since I started getting to know you better, and you talk a lot about this medication spellbinding.
Yeah.
I have become so aware, which I never really was as observant about this before, people in my room, in my office here, who are telling me I cannot even think about stopping taking these drugs or even reducing the dosage because this is the only thing that's helping me function, while they are not functioning at all.
Right, and in fact, if you could get them to talk about their lives, they would readily see that they've been functioning worse and worse ever since they got on them.
Right. Right.
But they think they're mentally ill. Their doctors are saying, well, you see, your illness is getting worse. Just happens to happen to all of the millions of you at the same time you start psychiatric drugs. Oh,
right.
God.
Well, and then the same thing goes on, again, just across all branches of medicine. So the person who starts out being 50 pounds overweight going to a doctor is told, you know, if this keeps going this way, you're going to end up being a diabetic. So the person ends up being a diabetic, but we have drugs for that. But the drugs actually cause weight gain and more glucose dysregulation. So you know what happens then? You get some more drugs. And then you eventually become insulin dependent. And while you're at it, because your arteries are getting damaged every day, you end up on an ACE inhibitor and a cholesterol-lowering drug, and you end up getting a couple of stents. And then pretty soon, you know, you're starting to get some gangrene on your toes. And so it's the same thing. The person who's going to doctors and spending a lot of money out of pocket these days, that's one thing. That everybody's finances would be better if they did what we're talking about. But insisting that these people have saved my life, really. You have two less toes than you used to have. You weigh 100 pounds more than you used to weigh. You're spending $450 out of pocket for drugs every month, and you're taking twice as many drugs as you were 5 years ago, and you think that this has benefited you. And what a sales job. I mean, when you think about it, one thing I do give medicine credit for in the drug companies is they are the masters of spin, because they can take the most miserable outcomes that you could possibly imagine that somebody can produce for a human being and make it seem as if they've done something good for them and make them believe it. So I wish I had that kind of spellbinding ability myself. I guess it must be a special gift to be able to do this, but it
takes
kind
a
of
few
astounding.
Billion dollars to inundate the culture with, too.
Yeah, that's true. We need a few billion dollars to tell a different story.
Yeah. One place I think I would disagree with you a little bit is I think that this is a lot more consciously planned at the top of these corporations. We see it when we go into the archives of these companies. You know, I see it when I'm doing product liability against them. They're systematically suppressing their adverse effects. They're systematically inflating their positive effects. And they're systematically not testing the drugs for more than a few weeks because they know they don't work after a few weeks at all and are making people worse. So I do think the more I do the product liability and I look at what goes on inside the FDA and inside the drug companies, that there's a lot of conscious planning. Just like you and I consciously try to live good lives, there's a lot of other people who are trying to consciously make money at any cost.
Yeah, and that might be, this might be the first time that anybody has ever heard somebody who has a harsher view of Big Pharma than I do. I'm usually accused of being the person in the room who's the hardest on the drug companies and the FDA and the other players involved. But I think you are probably right about that. And I think what's happened is that the system has a system that's set up the way that ours is can even take good people with good intentions and turn them into bad people. That's part of the problem, too.
That's been scientifically proven again and again in various situations.
Yeah, the Lucifer effect. I read that book written by the guy that did the experiment at Stanford. You put good people in a bad situation, and it only takes a matter of days for them to start to fall into some really bad behavior and harmful to others. So, yeah. Well, I think the key, I'll tell you where I think there's some hope. You know, sometimes you talk about all this doom and gloom, and it's such a huge problem. And so it can seem almost like, why try? Because it's so big it can't be fixed. But I really think it can be. And I'll tell you what I am seeing that's really encouraging. Let's make sure that we spend a few minutes on positive stuff, because I love this part. The first thing is that when I started, because of my alternative education, you know, I'm a naturopath, and medical doctors often have a very dim view of naturopaths. And by the way, so do I, even though I am one. But because I was a naturopath and I was talking about an alternative path to health that they didn't really have a lot of confidence in, people would say that they were coming to see me, and doctors would go out of their way to talk people out of it. And sometimes say some really disparaging things, you know. And that does not happen very often anymore. In fact, I had a young lady in my office today who's very sick, taking 11 drugs right now. And all of these drugs prescribed by one doctor, who she says is very nice, but we can probably agree he's a little quick with the prescription pad. But I always ask, you know, what does your doctor think of this? Does he know you're here? And she said, yeah, I told him I was coming. He thought it was a great idea. And I think that's progress. The mere fact that a medical doctor does not take the time anymore to denigrate my character and talk people out of coming here. And I've even had people who, doctors who've said, yeah, I read her book. Do what she says. What made me flabbergasted, just a few weeks ago, somebody came to one of our dinners and at the end came up to talk to me. And I said, who sent you here? She said, my oncologist from Ohio State University. He said, I was a lucky woman to survive the cancer I had, but I should not take that for granted. He gave me your name and phone number. He said, you go there, you talk to her, and do what she says. And so I think that's a big change. There are some people who are realizing that it's time to change thinking. They're a little bit more open-minded. So I think that's good. I'll tell you the second thing I think is wonderful is that people find each other on the Internet. Gosh, there's a lot of bad information on the Internet, the worst of humanity. But the good part is that folks start Googling and looking, and they find the documentaries on Netflix that I'm in, and they find your website, and they start taking action on their own behalf. That's why I'm busy all the time, and you're busy all the time. If I showed up here at 2 in the morning, there would be people willing to see me. I'm sure same thing with you. So that's all a good sign. People are seeking. They're starting to wake up a little bit. It's very hard to wake up a few hundred million people, but there are signs that it's happening. And I really think before the end of my life, we're going to see a big cataclysmic shift in medicine. And won't that be fun?
And won't you be a big part of it? And I'm just so pleased to be finding my way into this bigger picture with you, for which I am just tremendously grateful. Pam, what's the best way for people to hook up, first to learn about your nutritional ideas and to become informed by you? What are some of the best ways? There's probably a few, your books, your website, your courses.
Yeah.
What's
Well, a couple things. First of all, if somebody's thinking about coming to our conference next week, because we do have some amazing things going on, Dr. Ablin, who you've not met before, you're going to love him. He's going to talk about cancer immunotherapy and why it doesn't work, which I think is somebody has to start talking about that. Janice Fanger, her expertise is human aging, and she's going to talk about eating yourself younger, really, how you can postpone aging with the right diet. Eileen Kopsaftis, who you've had some experience with, is going to talk about resolving pain without drugs and surgery. So you can go to our website at wellnessformhealth.com. Lots of information, registration forms, all that stuff on the website. You can write to me, PamPopper@MSN.com. I answer all my emails personally. I put out a lot of free content. I do a newsletter on Monday, video clips on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and it's a way to get a college education over a period of time by subscribing. It's free. So send me an email if you'd like to be added to the subscriber list. Lots of stuff on our website, and then, of course, you can become a member and start taking our classes. We own a school. If you're a health professional listening to this and you're ready to open up your mind and learn how to help people in different ways, we own a school, and our school currently offers a program that Dr. Bregan helped to develop, which is called Why and How to Withdraw from Psychiatric Drugs. So lots of great programs going on here and lots of ways to participate. So contact us. You know, we're open 12 hours a day. You can call here and talk to humans. We think that human-to-human contact is really important and underutilized in the world today. So you can actually pick up the phone and call, and humans will talk to you.
And as always, I'd just be absolutely delighted if you come up to me at the conference and say, I'm here because of your radio show. that would make me very, very happy. It happened with a few folks at the last conference I co-sponsored with a psychology group. And I'd love to see it happen here at the upcoming conference. And folks, I'm probably not going to be doing another conference for quite a while. I mean, I just don't find the places I want to do them with other than with Pam right now. So keep that in mind. Maybe you'll end up making it an annual visit to Columbus, Ohio, which according to Pam has a lot better restaurants than you might think. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a great food town. It's a great food town. And somebody even told, a restaurant owner even told the Columbus newspaper in an interview a few months ago, new restaurant, she's talking about her menu, and then of course she says, for the people who eat a vegetarian or vegan diet, we have this, this, and this. And unsolicited, she said, you know, you can't really open a restaurant in Columbus today and do well unless you take care of people who eat this way. And I thought, wow, that's a big change. Because I remember when I used to go into restaurants and at the time I was vegetarian, since then I've adopted a vegan diet, but I tell people I was vegetarian, they go, oh, you're a veterinarian? I'd say, no. I'm a vegetarian. They look at me like, huh, I don't really know what that is, you know. So yeah. we've come a long way. And Columbus is a great town in other areas, too. I mean, you're going to come with me to the ballet next week, and we have one of the top dance companies in the whole country. You will be amazed at what you're going to see. You're going to say, I never thought I'd see anything like this in Columbus, Ohio.
Pam,
so our
Pam Popper, I love you, PhD, ND, my dear friend. Our time is up. What's the best, what book would you prefer people to look at, or what video in addition
food
to
over
other
medicine,
things?
Food Over Medicine. If you have Netflix, watch Food Choices.
Food Choices, great. And Food Over Medicine, great. Pam Popper, I'm going to see you next week.
Yes, you are, and I can't wait.
And I'm going to see Peter Goetze again. I've invited him to two other conferences in America, and we're going to see him again. I'm going to see him again. He is such a treat. I mean, imagine. My actually just making sure he got over here. And that, by the way, he's been helped through our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. The contributions that people occasionally make there, we don't push it a lot, have been used to bring Peter over. Pam, it's going to be a really good time. I'm going to meet a lot of new and interesting people. And you're going to film me for the remainder of the course that you're giving right now on why and how to stop taking psychiatric drugs. So it should be one of the more, and I'm going to eat better. I'm going to eat well. So it should be one of the more productive times of my life.
Thank you.
Bless you, and see you soon.
Take care.
And by my wonderful audience, I hope you're learning from this.